From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Nadine Gordimer talks with us about her life as a white South African opposed to apartheid and how that opposition has shaped her writing. Also today, we talk with screenwriter and director Robert Towne. He started out as a script doctor on films like The Godfather and Bonnie and Clyde. He went on to write such films as Shampoo, Chinatown, and Tequila Sunrise, which he also directed. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead looks back at the beginnings of Boogie Woogie Piano. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone tunes in HBO's new comedy channel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. NATO allies today gave a cool response to West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl's plan for an East-West German federation leading to eventual unity. President Bush said German unity should not be rushed and the Germans would have to decide their own future based on self-determination. Kohl acknowledged that his 10-point unity program, unveiled last week, had drawn a mixed reception during 5 hours of talks with NATO leaders in Brussels following the weekend's superpower summit in Malta. The East German government said today it's trying to prevent the destruction of evidence in ongoing investigations of government corruption. Deidre Berger has more from Berlin.
Former government leaders have been barred from their offices after rumors that some officials trying to smuggle sensitive material out of the country. The East German government today also asked West Germany and other European and Mideast countries to help locate Alexander Scholz-Golodowski, a foreign trade official who is suspected of siphoning off millions of dollars from the country's hard currency reserves. The government today set up a joint commission with opposition groups to uncover additional cases of corruption. Opposition figures today called for elections as early as May 6 in East Germany to stabilize the current political situation. Yesterday, the entire Communist Party leadership resigned. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
The Pentagon said today Soviet military personnel in East Germany detained a team of U.S. military officers for 7.5 hours on the eve of President Bush's summit with Soviet President Gorbachev. A Pentagon spokesman said the incident is under investigation. The military says the team was on an assigned mission involved with observing installations in East Germany. A ship owned by the environmental group Greenpeace is disabled off the Florida coast. Greenpeace claims it was rammed several times by the U.S. Navy during a protest against a test launch of a Trident II nuclear missile. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE in Orlando reports.
30 people are reportedly stranded on the Greenpeace vessel. The group says it was peacefully protesting an unarmed missile launch by the Navy sub USS Tennessee when it was rammed. Group spokeswoman Carol Bellin says the Navy put two holes in their mothership and even attacked inflatable motorboats.
Navy SEAL divers that were both in boats and in the water have slashed the fuel lines to those boats and slashed the inflatable pontoons on the boat, making those inoperable.
No injuries are reported aboard the Greenpeace vessel. Greenpeace lawyers say they're considering legal action against the U.S. Navy for the ramming. The Navy, for its part, says the Greenpeace vessel was in a restricted area and was warned several times to leave. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 6 points to close at 2753. This is NPR News. The Justice Department said today Attorney General Dick Thornburgh has ordered a preliminary criminal investigation into allegations of wrongdoing by former Housing Secretary Samuel Pierce. Department spokesman Dave Runkel said Thornburgh authorized the probe in response to calls in Congress. The preliminary inquiry began Saturday and can take up to 90 days. A lawyer for Pierce dismissed the move as insignificant, saying he's confident it will not result in the appointment of an independent counsel. Arab League ministers meeting in Riyadh will follow up their criticism of Lebanon's Christian leader General Michel Aoun with a report to their heads of state in other Arab countries. As the BBC's Peter Hyatt reports from the Arab League's headquarters in Tunis, its three-nation committee in Lebanon singled out General Aoun as the main problem in the way of a peace settlement.
The minister said General Aoun's rejection of the Taif Accords, when members of the Lebanese parliament agreed on a new constitution for the country, was the main obstacle to national reconciliation and the main reason for any dangerous escalation in the country. Aoun regards the accords as a surrender to Syria and has refused to recognize President Harawi. But the ministers warned that his attitude threatened to hold up the process of unification and plunge the country into disintegration. They called upon all Lebanese parties to show wisdom and self-restraint. And, in an apparent criticism of the opposition members of the French Parliament who went to Beirut recently to show their support for General Aoun, the ministers called upon international parties to support Lebanon's legitimacy.
BBC correspondent Peter Hyatt. Rival Shiite Muslim militias shelled villagers and fought running street battles today in southeast Lebanon. 10 people were killed, 30 were wounded. The United States today welcomed a statement by Angolan guerrilla leader Jonas Savimbi that he is ready to sign a ceasefire in the civil war in that country and called on Angola's Marxist government to make a similar declaration. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nadine Gordimer is one of South Africa's best-known writers. She's a longtime opponent of her country's racist policies and has written about the agonies of apartheid in her novels and short stories. In July's People, she imagined life during a civil war. In A Sport of Nature, she projected a vision of black majority rule. Gordimer is a vice president of PEN, the International Writers Union. Her latest book, The Essential Gesture, has just come out in paperback. It's a collection of essays written between the early 1950s and 1985. Many of these pieces are about what it means to be a writer in South Africa and where she sees herself fitting into the fight against apartheid as a white woman. Just a few weeks before I spoke with Nadine Gordimer last spring, the anti-apartheid activist David Webster had been assassinated in South Africa. Blacks and whites had gathered together at his funeral, disregarding the law. Gordimer told me that she saw this as a cause for optimism.
When you see black and white people coming together in the mass, out of respect and love for a man like David Webster, you feel optimism vis-à-vis the fears that people express to me here in America and outside, that whites, there'll be no place for whites in South Africa when we have black majority rule. I don't believe this, and I keep seeing evidence that it is not so. It depends upon whites. It depends how they behave. It depends which side they show they're on now, not just out of their mouths, but out of their actions as well.
I'm curious about when you became aware of apartheid. You grew up in South Africa. Your parents were emigres, your mother from London, your father, I think, from Lithuania. You grew up in a mining town. When did you become aware of apartheid?
Well, I think I was quite a late developer, really, when I consider the awareness, political awareness of my own children a generation later. But in that small town, you know how it is, particularly in a small town where you're not open to many other mind-blowing influences. You tend to adopt the attitudes and the mores of your parents and your teachers and so on. And I just took it as natural as a child that I went to a segregated school. I went to a convent school. All the kids were white. And that the only people, only blacks that I was in touch with were people doing the menial jobs, sweeping the streets, acting as servants, messengers, and so on. I mean, they were all around. And of course, as it was a mining town, there were thousands of black migratory miners who lived in their compounds, as we call them, barracks, quite near where we lived, but were completely separate from us, not only by language, but they just had no part in our lives. But when I was about, I was a great reader, and I really came to think about apartheid in terms of class injustice from reading people like Upton Sinclair when I was a teenager. And then I began to look around me, and I began to write very young, and by the time I was 17, I think the first published story that I wrote was indeed about apartheid, not in a formula form, but as it affected the lives of the people that I knew. It was about a police raid on a house for illicit liquor brewing by the black servant.
Was opposing apartheid, did that also mean that you had to oppose your parents? Did your parents support the system?
Well, my father, I think, did. You must remember that when I was a child, the word apartheid hadn't even been coined. And the apartheid government only came into power in 1948 when I was grown up. I'm talking about the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was a sort of colonial racism with quite a lot of paternalism mixed up in it. My mother had a social conscience and she did good works, and I don't say that sneeringly. She was one of the people who helped form a creche and clinic for black children in the nearby black ghetto, which we called township then. And she was always uneasy and angry if she saw black people being treated badly. But it was always as a form of charity. She didn't connect it with the law. She didn't connect it with the fact that they didn't have rights as white people had.
Was writing for you a response to injustice, or do you think you would have become a writer one way or another?
Writing was not a response to injustice. I wasn't even aware of injustice. I began to write out of a sense of wonder at life and also out of the mystery of life, wanting to find out what it was all about. It was my way of exploring life. And I think this is true of all artists. That's at the base of what we do. I don't think that any real artist begins from a political stimulation or conscience.
In the 1950s, you became friends with many black writers. Were there many obstacles at that time to developing friendships between black and white writers?
Yes, there were. But I think, as everywhere in the world, probably in the United States as well, writers and artists, actors, journalists, have tended to be people who don't really fit in to a conventional pattern of life and have more in common with one another and with the things that interest and absorb them, which cross colour, race, language, everything. And I think that this was true in South Africa as well. I had so much more in common with some young black person who was beginning to write than I had with the people in that mining town. So it was community of interest.
Did the people in your mining town see you as a traitor?
Well, I left there when I was quite young, and I don't know how they saw me. And while I was there and was quietly writing, it was very much a sort of secret activity. Nobody was particularly interested in it, which I think was a good thing for me. It left me to develop in my own way. I think they were a bit annoyed when my first book was published. My mother was still living there because it was set in a town like that. And first books are usually have quite a strong autobiographical element. So I think there was a bit of name spotting, you know, this is so-and-so and that's based on whatnot and tut-tut-tut, how could she do this?
Right. Nadine Gordimer is my guest, and she has a new collection of essays called The Essential Gesture. In one of your essays from 1959, you ask the question, where do whites fit in the new Africa? Nowhere, I'm inclined to say. What was the vision of the new Africa in the late 1950s?
Well, it was exciting, and it was strange that down in the south there, in the big toe of the continent, it seemed hardly to affect us at all, and this was partly due to lack of communication. It's always been much easier, and whites in South Africa have always been very Eurocentric, and indeed, when I was a young girl and a beginning writer, it was a dream of everybody then to go to London or to go to Paris. How could you possibly be a writer sitting, you know, in Johannesburg? Fortunately, I didn't ever have the money to go, and I think it was very fortunate because why become an expatriate for no reason and lose your background and your home? I'm a bit worried about that essay because many people don't notice that, as you did, that it was dated 59. It's a very long time ago. I didn't alter any of my opinions or bring them up to date in that book because I thought a personal book like this shows the development of one's opinions and one's responses to one's time in society. But I obviously, in 1959, doubted whether there would be a place for whites to continue to live in Africa. But so far as South Africa is concerned, I certainly don't believe that now. And I haven't believed it for many years. I'm quite sure that there is a place for whites, that the African National Congress, the Premier Liberation Movement, has always been non-racial, still is. And it's simply a matter, it's not a simple matter for many whites, it's a matter of whites learning how to live in a different way, truly accepting what is coming, which is black majority rule, and not fearing, not wanting guarantees of group rights, which will set them aside, set them apart, mark them out forever. We've never had a Bill of Rights in South Africa. I think if the rights of the individual are guaranteed, what do you want to need to guarantee group rights for? You're only keeping the demarcation of colour and class there forever. I think whites certainly have a big part to play in the future free, non-racial South Africa, but they must learn to live differently. They can't be wanting to be the boss and ordering other people around and doing their thinking for them.
I've heard some whites in South Africa who've done liberal or radical work say that they fear, nevertheless, that if there is a revolution, there will be so much unleashed rage against white people, and understandably so, and this rage will not discriminate against white people who've been against apartheid and white people who've supported it, and on an individual basis, a lot of people won't know the difference. You know, people won't be wearing ID cards. Do you ever worry about that?
No, I must say I don't. I'm interested to hear that this should have come to you from people who have been active, because this is the kind of fear that comes from people who've never done anything with blacks.
Oh, I won't mention names here, because one person in particular who said that to me, who I'm thinking of.
Yes. I think it might have been true, it was true, in the 70s, during the separatist, black separatist time.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the United Democratic Front still operating under great difficulty, half banned, in the 80s there's been a great revival of democratic action across the colour line.
Was there a moment or a period where you stopped fluctuating between staying in South Africa or leaving and you just decided to stay?
Oh, there have really only been in my life one or two moments when I thought at all of leaving South Africa.
What were those moments?
Well, actually, they were in the 60s when, through personal circumstances, I could have gone to live in Zambia. And I went, I'd been travelling quite a bit in Central Africa generally, Tanzania, Kenya, Zambia. And I had what I realised later was a romantic idea that I could then commit myself to an African country as an African. Whereas in South Africa, there was the struggle against white supremacists in the 60s. You must remember it was after Sharpeville. The African National Congress was banned. The other liberation movements were banned. And there was just a feeling of total stalemate that the apartheid government was going to be there forever. And I didn't want to spend my life as a white living in the white lager, struggling to keep contact with blacks. But I think fortunately for me, I discovered on visits to Zambia, much as I liked the country and the people, that there I was just regarded as a European. I was just a white person like people from expatriates from England working there or from any other country. Whereas at home, in my own country, there's never been a time when I felt I wasn't recognized as a white African.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about South Africa and about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Nadine Gordimer. Her latest book is a collection of essays called The Essential Gesture, including essays written between 1950 and 1985. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Nadine Gordimer is the author of many collections of short stories as well as novels. Her books include A Sport of Nature, July's People, The Lying Days, and Something Out There. And I believe three of your books have been censored, is that right?
Three of my books have been banned over the years in South Africa. But lately, nothing of mine has been banned. And I optimistically hope that nothing will be. I think there's a certain protection becoming well-known outside. As I've become better known in the outside world, it has seemed hardly worthwhile for the government to ban a writer like myself, not a terribly easy writer to read. So that I think the calculation is that it's not worth the fuss that there is when a book of mine is banned, the fuss that there is in the outside world as well as at home. But in any case, censorship, the real clout of censorship, has moved from the censorship banning of books to that of muzzling the press. The real heat is on the press, the media generally.
Mm-hmm. Is censorship almost a badge of honor? When your book has been censored, you know, knowing that the government was so outraged by it that they don't even want other people to read it.
Yes, I suppose so in a way, but really for me that's offset by the fact that it cannot be read by your own people then.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, now very few works of fiction are banned, and even quite tough non-fiction works. This is also because if they're on a certain level, they're not going to find a very large reading public. And you must remember there's complete control of television. It's all state television. People like myself don't write for television. We don't appear in discussion programs. We are muzzled in this way.
Well, let me read to you a statement that you once said about writing. You said that the best way to write is to do so as if one were already dead, afraid of no one's reactions, answerable to no one's views. What led you to say that? And I guess I wonder if you've taken heat by, on both sides in South Africa.
No, this was just a conviction that goes really deeper than that. I think that a writer must always maintain the independence, the artistic independence, to use his or her insights, something that a writer has beyond the insights of other people, without worrying whether you're going to offend your mother, your best friend, or whether your political confreres are going to decide that you have let down the side. A writer must never let herself become a propagandist. Propagandists have a place, agitprop has a place, but I'm not that kind. I'm not that person. I'm a writer. I have a certain ability, and I feel the first duty is to use that ability properly. The nearest you can get to the truth, you get through using that ability properly, not worrying what anybody's going to say. That's why I would stand by that old statement, you know, that you must write as if you're already dead and not worry about the consequences. Because as soon as you've got your eye on an audience, on people who are watching, you're going to hear what you have to say. You're going to falsify that little extra vision you have that will bring you near to the truth. And in the end, if we look at your position, the writer's position in society, the essential gesture to society, in the end, it is what you're going to be able to record and discover of the truth that is going to serve your society best.
Do you feel that you've ever been expected to write books that would be more effective propaganda?
Oh, yes. Indeed.
Where has that pressure come from?
Well, it hasn't really been pressure. And it hasn't usually come from quarters that bothered me very much. Because I feel that if I took no part in community life and lived in an ivory tower, then perhaps I might listen to it. But I'm also a human being, a citizen, and I know that I have a certain responsibility toward my society for what's happened there, what's happened in my name as a white, whether I had anything to do with it or not. And so I have another part of my life which, where I put my life on the line for what I believe in. And I think, therefore, I have the freedom to write as I feel I must, as I please. I'm not retiring into an ivory tower because I am doing other things as a human being and a citizen.
We talked a little earlier about how in the 1950s you became good friends with many black writers from South Africa. Is it any more difficult now to keep connections like that? What I mean is, do government restrictions make it really difficult to get together and to communicate?
No, only insofar as you know that when you're in organizations like our new writers' organization, of which I was one of the founders, it's only just going to be 2 years old in July. It's very young still. We know that we are watched because part of our preamble to our constitution is that we are committed to the liberation of South Africa. We are committed to working with and encouraging a grassroots culture, which means working with the cultural groups in trade unions, We make no excuses for it. We are a political organization because culture is political. We want to create a new culture. We know that we're watched when some of our members, not through directly through their activities with us, but through other activities, have been detained. They are quite closely questioned about us. So that there isn't anything in the that you do across the colour line without racial division, or even with racial division, if it's against the regime, that it doesn't bring you some kind of risk. But you can still mix as a writer with your black colleagues, if you wish, as long as you have what is really in common. First of all, the desire to do good work, and secondly, to understand your responsibility as a writer to other people who are struggling to learn to write, who have had fewer educational opportunities. And this applies to blacks as well as whites, because you have some of our writers, black writers, that teach in universities or run alternative education establishments. In other words, they're white-collar people. And there are lots and lots of people in the trade unions, among mine workers, peasants in the country, who long to write and to read. They don't have the libraries and they don't have the ability to express themselves. We feel it's part of our duty of being writers to work with them and help them.
It's interesting. You see it as a political responsibility.
Yes. It's a political and a professional and artistic responsibility.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a new organization of writers that you helped to found. What is it called?
It's called the Congress of South African Writers, COSOR. And it's really spreading out into the country. We try to get away from the concentration in the big cities with our readings and workshops. And we are about 95% black membership now. But by black, I mean we call black people that you call coloured, people who are of Indian descent, people who are of mixed blood and so on. But we have a 95% black membership.
One last question. What do you need to do to make sure that the organization doesn't get banned and get forced underground?
Well, we can't do anything, because then we would be stifling our real convictions. We simply go on doing what we think is right, and we're prepared to take the consequences.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you. Nadine Gordimer's book of essays, The Essential Gesture, has just come out in paperback. It includes her writings from the 1950s up through 1985. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be the film director Costa Gavras. His political thrillers include Z, State of Siege, Missing, and Betrayed. His new film, The Music Box, stars Jessica Lange as the daughter of a man accused of Nazi war crimes. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Towne wrote the screenplays for Shampoo in Chinatown. He wrote and directed Personal Best and Tequila Sunrise. Coming up, Towne tells us the stories behind some now classic movie scenes. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead has an appreciation of boogie-woogie piano, inspired by a new book and reissue on the subject. And now there's a way to get laughs 24 hours a day. Critic at large Laurie Stone checks out HBO's Comedy Channel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The U.S. Attorney General has announced that he has decided to start an inquiry that could lead to the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Samuel Pierce. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Attorney General Richard Thornburgh has ordered the start of a preliminary inquiry. Under the independent counsel law, the Justice Department now has 60 days to perform that inquiry. Once it is completed, the Attorney General will decide whether there is enough evidence to ask a special judicial panel to appoint an independent counsel. Lawmakers who have been part of the HUD investigation say there is evidence of a conspiracy by Pierce and others at HUD to defraud the government by giving grants to their friends and colleagues. And they say there is also the question of perjury. Pierce's testimony in May before a congressional committee has been contradicted by other witnesses. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
M. Danny Wall has resigned as the government's chief regulator of savings and loans, amid controversy over his role in the biggest SNL bailout in history. At a news conference today in Washington, Wall insisted that he had done nothing wrong. He also charged that a steady stream of one-sided information has come from Housing Banking Committee hearings concerning his handling of Lincoln's savings and loan. For nearly 2 months, Wall has been the chief target of hearings on Capitol Hill into why federal regulators allowed Lincoln to stay open, even though federal examiners had recommended that it be closed. In Moscow today, leaders of five Warsaw Pact countries issued a condemnation of the Soviets' 1968 military invasion of Czechoslovakia, calling it illegal interference in the country. Ann Cooper has more on the story.
The statement was issued by the five countries whose troops crushed the reform drive known as Prague Spring. They were the Soviet Union, Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, and East Germany. The Soviet government issued a separate statement today, its first official apology for the Prague repressions. The other invaders have each issued independent condemnations, and Communist Party leaders in Czechoslovakia last week also denounced the invasion. The Warsaw Pact leaders came to Moscow today to hear Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's assessment of his weekend summit with George Bush. Official reports gave few details about the summit briefings. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Chanting "They must go," more than 150,000 people demonstrated in Prague today, demanding free elections and rejecting the new communist-dominated government. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 5.5 points to close at 2,753.41 on volume of some 150,360,000 shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Boogie Woogie is a highly percussive form of blues piano playing, developed mostly by self-taught musicians sometime around the end of the last century. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an exploration of Boogie Woogie, prompted by a new book and a reissued recording.
Even if you don't follow jazz or blues, you probably know boogie-woogie piano when you hear it. That combination of hypnotic bass lines and polyrhythmic chords was such a big craze in the early 1940s, it still reverberates through American music. But despite boogie-woogie's one-time popularity, only now has a book about it been published, A Left Hand Like God by British author Peter Sylvester. It's a paperback from DeCapo Press. The title comes from a remark U.B. Blake once made about pianist William Turk. It reminds us that a steady and powerful left hand is at the heart of boogie piano. That's Meade Lux Lewis in 1936 playing his Honky Tonk Train Blues. Boogie Woogie players had an affinity for train songs. Back around the turn of the century, when the style was relatively new, boogie pianists were often found at backwoods logging camps in the South, where they played battered uprights for entertainment-starved workers. Musicians traveled between the camps by bumming rides on freight trains. There is an obvious link between the clickety-clack of the rails and the headlong momentum of the piano style. Those train echoes persisted even after boogie piano players gravitated to northern cities. Dual pianists Albert Ammons and Pete Johnson recorded their subway-inspired blues, Sixth Avenue Express, in 1941. Boogie became a national fad after Albert Ammons, Pete Johnson, and Meade Lux Lewis played at John Hammond's first Spirituals to Swing concert at Carnegie Hall in December 1938. A few weeks later, Barney Josephson opened his Greenwich Village Club Cafe Society, where the three pianists were featured for the next year and a half. That boom period was when major record companies began paying close attention. The music in this review comes from a new collection on RCA Bluebird, Barrel House Boogie, mostly recorded between 1939 and 41. It contains duets by Johnson and Ammons and solos by Lewis and Jimmy Yancey, who also sings a couple of tunes. The reissue makes the case for Boogie Woogie as a prime source for rock and roll and New Orleans R&B. Jimmy Yancey's Yancey Stomp includes a lick derived from King Oliver's 1923 Chimes Blues that later became a favorite of pianists like Professor Longhair. The decline of Boogie Woogie by the late 1940s followed a familiar pattern. Commercial bands seized on the fad, copying its most obvious mannerisms, and diluting the original until everyone was sick of it. The obvious example is the Andrews Sisters' Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Peter Sylvester's book chronicles the music's rise and fall, and its recent revival in Europe, which missed the craze the first time around. In the early 1940s, Europeans had something more pressing on their minds. The book is most interesting when Sylvester examines Boogie Woogie's origins in the South and Midwest. By digging deep into those early years, he also throws light on the larger issue of how far jazz had proliferated before it appeared on record in 1917. The notion that jazz was played only in New Orleans back then has always been contested by musicians from other places. As Sylvester points out, black improvisers traveled widely in the years around the turn of the century, spreading their music around the country. Jazz was in the air, and if New Orleans was one center for the music, it wasn't the only one. Rhythmic improvising on blues-based music, in the form of boogie-woogie or jazz, was an idea too good to be kept in one place.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Barrel House Boogie on the RCA Bluebird label and Peter J. Sylvester's new book, A Left Hand Like God, published by DeCapo Press.
Got our little girls all dressed in red. I received one letter, little girls all dressed in red. Then he said down the bottom, Jim, your baby's dead. And I wrote back one letter, dressed in white and black. All I wrote back one...
This is Fresh Air. In the 1970s, Robert Towne became known as one of the best screenwriters in Hollywood. He was brought in as a script doctor for Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, and he wrote the screenplays for The Last Detail, Shampoo, and Chinatown. In 1975, Pauline Kael described Towne as a flaky classicist with an ear for unaffected dialogue and a gift for never forcing a point. Towne has written a sequel to Chinatown. It's called The Two Jakes. It's directed by Jack Nicholson, the star of Chinatown, and it's scheduled to be released this spring. Robert Towne is also a director. In 1982, he directed his own screenplay for the film Personal Best. The second film he both wrote and directed is the thriller Tequila Sunrise. It starred Mel Gibson and Kurt Russell as two former best friends who are on opposite sides of the law. I asked Towne if he wrote more in shorthand when he knew that he would be the one interpreting the script.
In some ways, it's more difficult directing your own script because you do make that assumption. You as the director, I as the director, make the assumption that I must know what this script is about since I wrote it. But the press of events on a set, all the technological problems and all the Rube Goldberg machinery of a movie is such that... you are just as affected by it as any other director, and you may have less of a tendency to do what a director who has not written the script does do, which is to say, what is this scene really about it at the most basic level? And I think a writer-director has to constantly remind himself to ask the same question he would had he not written the script. What is this scene about?
Tequila Sunrise is your first film since 1982 when you wrote and directed Personal Best. I know that that film ended in a lawsuit, and then you ended up going through a divorce and a custody battle. And I was wondering if those events were responsible for the hiatus between films.
Yes. What can I say? I think that it certainly put a dent in my ability to work professionally.
By that, do you mean that you personally weren't up for making a movie, or that it was hard for you to get others to give you the chance to make one?
Well, I mean, I'll never know that, really, because the first time that I was able to complete writing something that I wanted to direct, which was Tequila Sunrise, I was given the opportunity to direct it. I do think that that when your real life... when your day-to-day life, when your becomes more interesting and fascinating than your fantasy life, it interferes with your ability to write fantasy because you're living it. And when melodramatic events occur in your life, when it just becomes time-consuming, then your ability to obsess about a fantasy is more limited. So I think that it necessarily interferes with your ability to work. I don't know whether or not, had I finished something in that time frame, I would have been given the opportunity to direct it. All I know is that when I did finish something, I was given the opportunity.
You wrote the screenplay for Chinatown. Roman Polanski directed it. Polanski played a small role in the film. He played the part of a henchman who's hired to intimidate Nicholson to get off the case.
And what Polanski does is take out a pocket knife, stick it into Nicholson's nose, and basically slit his nostril open. The line that you gave him to say was, "Know what happens to nosy fellows? They lose their noses." Why did you want to cut the nose? It seems like such an interesting, really offbeat way of hurting somebody.
Well, I was looking for a way to do something that I felt would appeal to your imagination in terms of just a tiny little violent act that was scary. I really didn't want to go into the kinds of violence that had been rife throughout films at that time. I wanted to have a minimal amount of violence, but I wanted to suggest that it was nevertheless a very violent world out there. So I thought of something that I would really hate to have happen to me, and it was that. And it seemed appropriate for a detective anyway. A detective who is like a hound, is sniffing out the trail of some kind of criminal or villain. It just seemed like the perfect thing to do.
What was very subversive about it was that it meant that Jack Nicholson, the leading man, had a bandage on his nose for half the movie. And even when he took the bandage off, he had a big cut and stitches on his nose.
Well, once again, in most movies, you can see people fight in a way that would have crushed skulls, created probably, quadriplegics with both combatants, and they emerge unscathed from the battle and continue to go out throughout the film with a bruise here or there, which disappears in the next scene. Well, in fact, that doesn't happen. I mean, if somebody gets hurt, it hurts. Just a tiny little slit in your nose can really smart, and it can affect the way you look and feel for weeks, and in this case, for the rest of the movie. It was just an attempt to just like Chinatown was an attempt to deal with a real crime that involved something as seemingly prosaic as land and water, that little act of violence was an attempt to suggest that you can really hurt people by doing almost nothing at all, just a tiny little slit of their nose.
I want to ask you a little bit about writing a climactic scene, a scene in which there's really a turning point in the story or in their character development. In Chinatown, the real turning point scene, or at least one of them, is when Faye Dunaway reveals that the woman whose identity she's been hiding is really her daughter as a result of an incestuous relationship. Her father had, the Faye Dunaway father had raped her when she was 15. And I want to just play a clip from this scene and then ask you a little bit about the considerations in writing this kind of climax.
I don't know what you are talking about. This is the craziest, the most insane thing.
Stop it! I'm going to make it easy for you. You were jealous. You had a fight. He fell. He hit his head. It was an accident. But his girl is a witness. So you had to shut her up. You don't have the guts to harm her, but you got the money to keep her mouth shut. Yes or no?
No!
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth. Oh!
It's a really such a dramatic way of bringing across that revelation, and to have, especially with the slaps in between, that's, I don't know if people can make that out in the clip that we heard. But can I ask you about planning that, writing that climax, and if you had written in the slaps, if you thought that would add to the drama of the moment?
Well, yes, they were written in. I think that any revelation of any kind is only credible, particularly one that is shameful, at least whether or not there's any moral stigma attached to it. It certainly is embarrassing for the Faye Dunaway character to have to admit to it. And the only way you're going to believe that what she says is true is if she's reluctant to talk about it, and that's putting it mildly. I think that, as a general rule, anything that you want an audience to believe is something that a character has to reveal reluctantly. Any kind of free and easy revelation is one that I think we automatically suspect is not true. We just, you know, glibness is, whether or not it is in fact true, it's certainly dramatically true that glibness is generally tantamount to insincerity.
Were there directors who let you on the set, let you sit in before you started directing yourself? And I ask this knowing that a lot of times screenwriters aren't really welcomed on the screen because the director wants to be able to make choices himself or herself without the screenwriter standing over their shoulder and making their own suggestions.
I have always been, maybe it's because I started so much of my work by doing rewrites that I didn't have the kind of threatening cachet of the originator of a piece of material, which I think is always a threat to a director since it reminds him that he's in the role of basically an interpretive artist. And since I wasn't in that position, I was less of a threat in the early stages of my career, and it did allow me to be on sets. I was expected to be on sets because I was rewriting very often on a daily basis and had to be there with the pages for everyone to go over what I'd done to see if it was going to work. So I automatically spent a great deal of time on sets. Almost every director I ever worked with not only allowed me on the set, but insisted on it.
Is that how you learned how to direct, by watching?
I don't know how anybody learns to direct. I suppose the best training I had was how I learned to write, by being in acting classes and watching really fine actors improvise. I think that it not only helped me in terms of screenwriting, but it probably was the single best training I had to work with actors in movies.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us about movies. Thank you for your time. Screenwriter and director Robert Towne. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what kind of post-summit coverage do you have?
President Bush is in Brussels briefing the NATO pact, and Gorbachev is back in the Soviet Union briefing the Warsaw Pact, so we will be covering both of those stories, Terry. We're also following efforts in Germany and in Czechoslovakia, in East Germany and Czechoslovakia, to replace governments with new governments. The state of the rebellion in the Philippines, we keep hearing that it's being put down, but on the other hand, they keep fighting. And we have a couple of features, including a young man who decided that he didn't want to go to the father-son sports banquet if his mom couldn't go.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. HBO has inaugurated a new basic cable service that's all comedy all the time. Critic at Large Laurie Stone has an assessment of the Comedy Channel.
The Comedy Channel broadcasts continual humor. That's 8,760 hours a year devoted to getting laughs. Eddie Gordetsky, the channel's head writer, explains the need for so much humor by saying that radio's no good, drugs are passé, and sex is too dangerous. What else is there to do? Another explanation is that right now, comedy is the largest grossing segment of the entertainment industry. Network television mostly serves up reassuring comedy in the form of sitcoms and talk shows. The Comedy Channel intends to spike that menu with novelty and surprise. There's some chance it will, judging by early offerings and by Gorodetsky's love of disruption. The Comedy Channel is a startlingly pure projection of his personality, including his lifelong consumption of popular media and scholarship, and his penchant for grafting private obsessions onto public icons. The format of the channel is shaped by his affection for old-fashioned broadcast intimacy, the use of characters who speak directly to the audience. Four main hosts do shtick and serve as video jockeys, introducing 2 to 3 minute comedy clips culled from movies, stand-up routines, and variety shows. One of the hosts, Tommy Sledge, is an over-the-hill private eye. He slinks around a dusty office and talks in the hard-boiled patter of noir pulp.
I was down at Henny's last night, my favorite dump, and this little damester dragged in. She was gorgeous, but she was obviously down to her last penny. She wanted a drink, a little hooch. I slipped her a fin, my last five. I said, go ahead, damester, knock yourself out.
Urbane Alan Havey is in a single guy's apartment. The Brooklyn Bridge sparkles outside his picture window as he sasses sexual gamesmanship.
You got that big convention coming up in Michigan. Wife can't make it, but Tweed Skirt will be there. A lot of long hours, a lot of little jokes. Hey, don't come up to my room, 1202. But what if you hear that in the middle of the night? You're gonna feign sleep, go to bed? Are you going to open up that door to 6 weeks of naughty coworker passion, a seething affair? And then what? Discovery, shame, divorce, alimony, a one-bedroom apartment with a plastic wall unit, black and white TV with aluminum foil wrapped around the antenna. You think about that.
Gorodetsky cares about the past. He's attracted to the emotionalism that embarrasses sarcasm mongers like David Letterman and Dennis Miller. But some limitations are already clear. Much of the comedy feels like it's grown in a hothouse. It's self-referential, a series of clips and cues triggering memories and a sense of excitement without a point of view. Missing in this airless, hermetic videoscape is a sense of spontaneity and of being in the world, feelings that stand-up comedy in clubs generates. The best hope lies in Gorodetsky's sense of mischief. He describes an amusing bit planned called Celebrity Math, the brainchild of writer Mark O'Donnell. In my favorite caprice, three intersecting circles are drawn and labeled smart, ugly, and rock star. At the convergence of smart and ugly is Sart. Where ugly and rock star meet is Ozzy Osbourne. Where smart and rock star join, there's Sting. And at the junction of smart, ugly, and rock star, there's, of course, Bob Dylan. If this kind of cleverness can be spun out regularly, the Comedy Channel will offer an alternate route to laugh track predictability.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Fresh Air is produced this week by Danny Miller and Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Costa Gavras, the director of such political thrillers as Z, Missing, Betrayed, and the new film, The Music Box. Also, we go back to the roots of rock and roll with singer, guitarist, and record producer Dave Edmonds. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.